Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and today we are going to take a break from reading the NALC Constitution. The next section is the rules governing state associations, and frankly, I'm not as interested in that. Certainly not as interested as I am in today's topic, which is the NALC regulations governing branch election procedures. 2 days from today, as I record this, I am going to be nominated for vice president of my local branch, or at least I think I will, but I might not be because, well, wait till we get to section five of these rules, because, oh boy, howdy, there is some shit coming. So let's get into it so that we can get to section five. This booklet was given to me, if I remember right, it was actually given to me at the CLC meeting here in Las Vegas. I think it might have been given to me by, I don't remember. I think it was given to me by Charlie Miller, but I'm not positive. Who knows? Anyway, it's coming very handy. So it opens with, I'm reading from a PDF version, but it's identical. It opens with a message from Frederick Rolando, the president emeritus of the NALC, to all branch officers. NALC has a proud tradition of union democracy. At the national level, we hold elections that permit every member to vote by mail for the union's leadership. We also give every active member the right to vote when it comes time to ratify or reject tentative contracts. But our dedication to democracy also applies to local union elections. We are committed to the idea that fair, honest, and open elections at the branch level are vital to a democratic union and essential to the long-term health of the NALC. The rules and regulations contained in this booklet were promulgated by the NALC Executive Council pursuant to its constitutional authority. Article 5, Section 5C of the NALC Constitution provides, quote, "The National Executive Council is hereby empowered to adopt and promulgate the rules and regulations for the conduct of all elections in the branches," end quote. See also NALC Constitution Article 9, Section 11, E2. The Executive Council enacted the first set of rules and regulations governing elections at the branch level in November 1981. Amendments were subsequently adopted in March 2008 and March 2011. The most recent changes consist of minor clarifications and updated references to applicable law and Department of Labor regulations. The handbook contains A. Commentary sections, B. Samples of nominations and election notices, ballots, and envelopes for mail balloting, C. an election timetable and related checklists, and D. an explanatory chart of the election appeals process. Please read this handbook carefully and use it as a reference guide when holding your next branch election. It provides detailed information about how to do your election the right way. If you follow the guidelines provided in this booklet, you will help preserve and strengthen the NALC's well-deserved reputation as one of the most democratic unions in America. Thank you for doing your part. Sincerely, Frederick Rolando. Dude, reading prose is so much easier than reading like contract language. Oh man, that was a breeze to get through. And well put by Frederick Rolando. And it's important, you know, that people who are going to be holding elections read this book. That's why it exists. And I sure wish my branch would have read it, but we'll get into that a little bit later. All right, so we start out with 1.0 introduction. By the way, the numbering system of this is similar to what we ran into in the M39, where it's 1.0, 1.1. If there's something sub that, it'll be 1.11, and then 1.2, 1.21, 1.211, stuff like that. 1.0, introduction. 1.1, the following rules and regulations governing the conduct of elections at branch level were originally promulgated by the Executive Council on November 13, 1981, to be effective for all elections taking place on or after July 1, 1982. Amendments to these rules and regulations were adopted by the Executive Council on March 8, 2008. Additional amendments were approved by the Executive Council as of March 24, 2011. The Executive Council is empowered to adopt and promulgate such rules pursuant to Article 5, Section 5C, and Article 9, Section 11E of the NALC Constitution. These rules are in compliance with Title 4 of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act of 1959, LMRDA, a federal law applicable to the NALC with the passage of the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970. They are also in compliance with the election provisions in the NALC Constitution and the NALC Constitution for the government of subordinate and federal branches. The Executive Council may exempt branches from any of these regulations to the extent permitted by law. However, branches must request an exemption at least 90 days before the scheduled date of the election. Branches may also adopt additional rules in their own bylaws, provided the rules are not inconsistent with federal law, the NALC Constitution, and these regulations. And thus ends part one. And guys, it's important to note that these rules, these are our own internal rules based on the NALC Constitution and our bylaws, but these also correspond to Department of Labor rules. There are a bunch of rules in the LMRDA about how unions are supposed to behave. And at some point, we'll get into those as well. But a lot of the stuff is rooted in requirements of the LMRDA. So if you violate these election rules, you're not just violating NALC rules. In many cases, you're also violating federal labor laws or Department of Labor regulations. All right, 2.0, who must be elected? 2.1, branch bylaws must specify what officers and positions must be elected as follows. All branch officers as defined in the NALC Constitution or branch bylaws. Branch stewards if they are members of the branch executive board. Delegates and alternate delegates to the national and state association conventions. Any other branch position which has executive or policymaking authority or responsibility. 2.11. Branch stewards and any other persons who are members of the branch executive board or similar body must be elected by the entire branch, not just the station or area they represent. Comments. Title 4 of LMRDA states that all local union officers must be elected. According to the NALC Constitution, local branch officers consist of president, vice president, recording secretary, financial secretary, treasurer, sergeant at arms, health benefits representative, and a board of trustees, 3 to 5 members. Branches do have the option, however, of providing in their bylaws for the consolidation or addition of officers of the branch. Department of Labor regulations interpreting the LMRDA state that any person who has executive or policymaking authority or responsibility must be elected. This provision can sometimes be misunderstood. For example, branch stewards do not normally have to be elected. However, if a branch steward is also a member of the branch executive board, he or she must be elected due to the executive authority of the board. Furthermore, such stewards must be elected by the entire branch because the executive board makes policy for the entire branch membership. So there you go. If you're going to be running things, if you're going to be making policy decisions, then you have to be elected. In my branch, we also elect stewards, but they're only elected by the station that they represent. Next, 3.0, timing of elections. Elections should take place at a time specified in branch bylaws, but at least every 3 years for local officers or other elected branch positions. At my branch, it's every 3 years, but honestly, I wouldn't mind going to something more frequent, like 2 years. Maybe that's something that can be discussed down the road. 3.2, delegates and alternate delegates to the national and state association conventions are to be elected no later than December of the year preceding each convention year. Comments. Federal law states that local elections must be held at least every 3 years. However, Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution for the government of subordinate and federal branches provides that branch officers, quote, shall be elected for a term of 1, 2, or 3 years at the option of the branch, end quote. Branch bylaws should state whether elections will be held for 1, 2, or 3 year terms of office. Next, 4.0, eligibility for nominations. 4.1, all regular members, as defined in Article 2, Section 1A of the NALC Constitution, are eligible to hold any office or position in the branch, with the following exceptions. 4.11, any regular member who holds or, oh, you guys know what's coming, the prohibition on supervisors. Well, here it is. Any regular member who holds, accepts, or applies for a supervisory position in the Postal Career Service, in the Postal Career Service for any period of time, no matter how brief, is ineligible during the tenure of that position and for a period of 2 years after the termination of supervisory status. This exception includes temporary, probationary, and permanent supervisors. The two-year restriction begins upon receipt by the branch of a written notice from the member that his or her supervisory status has been terminated. All right, so just like in the other places, if you are a supervisor, no thank you. You are not welcome. Comments. Normally, a member who has served in a supervisory position should notify the branch in writing of the termination of supervisory status to ensure that his or her eligibility to hold branch office is restored 2 years thereafter. However, presidential rulings have established that in those cases where it can be shown that a member has not served in a supervisory status for more than 2 years, the member's failure to provide formal written notice of the termination of supervisory status will not, by itself, disqualify the member from serving as a union officer. So that seems reasonable to me. If the prohibition is that you can't run within 2 years of being a supervisor, well, as long as it's been 2 years, you're good to go. All right, next, 4.12. Any person convicted of robbery, bribery, extortion, embezzlement, grand larceny, burglary, arson, violation of narcotics laws, murder, rape, assault with intent to kill, assault which inflicts grievous bodily injury, or a violation of Title II or III of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, any felony involving misuse of such person's position in a labor organization to obtain an illegal gain at the expense of members or the labor organization, or conspiracy to commit any such crimes or attempt to commit any such crimes, is ineligible to run until 13 years following conviction or release from prison, whichever is later. All right, criminals not welcome. Now we get to the good stuff. Section 5, Notice of Nominations and Elections. So this came up two Constitution episodes ago when I was reading the constitutional requirements for notification. And we have our nominations in a couple of days from when I record this. So what are the notification requirements? Well, let's find out. 5.0. Notice of nominations and elections. And by the way, I have noticed that sometimes I'd say 5.0, sometimes I say 5.0. I don't know what to tell you. My preference is 5.0, but sometimes I get lackadaisical. Anyway, 5.1. Recording secretary must notify every member by mail of nominations and the upcoming elections at his or her last known home address. The notice must be mailed to each member at least 45 days before the election. Guys, notice that twice in here they use the word must. The recording secretary must notify every member, and the notification must be mailed out at least 45 days before the election. All right, so that's 5.1. 5.11, this provision may be satisfied by A, timely direct mailing of notice to the membership, B, timely publication of the notice in the postal record. All right, so this gives a little flexibility. If you can't afford to mail this out to every member of your branch, or for maybe just because it's easier, you can put the notice in the postal record. And when, you know, I talked on a podcast about, boy, I don't remember seeing this notice, I went and looked in back issues of the postal record. They're very easy to come upon. They have this cool flipbook thing on the NALC website that lets you read it like a normal magazine. And I went to the appropriate issue, and there were 7 pages of election notifications, none of them from Las Vegas. All right. And C, timely publication in a mailed branch publication. The notice must be published on the front page in a conspicuous position. So this is the last option. If it doesn't get mailed to everybody's house, which I don't remember seeing it mailed to my house, then they can publish, and it, I know it didn't get put in the postal record, they can publish it in the branch publication The notice must be published on the front page in a conspicuous position. Notice the word again, must. It must be published on the front page. 5.12, mailing list must be up to date. 5.13, posting the notice on station bulletin boards does not satisfy the provision. Comments. These notification provisions ensure that all regular members have enough time to nominate candidates of their own choice as required by federal law. So here we are. We're invoking federal law because the idea is that the incumbents almost always win these elections. And there is some basic fairness issues at play here. Like, I'll give you an example. The incumbent officers of our branch can go make appearances at stations all around the Las Vegas Valley. And they just have to give notification, hey, I'm coming to the station tomorrow for a visit. And then they come in, they walk the workroom floor. Hey, I'm blah, blah, blah. I'm your current, you know, executive vice president or whatever. And how you doing? How's everything going? And that's not technically campaigning, but it serves the same purpose. You know, it gets your name out there. It helps you put a face to the name, things like that. And me as a challenger, I can't do that. When I went campaigning the other day, I had to stand outside the building out on the street. And as people were leaving for work that day, then I had to hand them my literature, like as they were going off of postal property and we're all off the clock. So that makes it a lot harder as a challenger to take on the incumbent. So this notification provision ensures, as it says, that all regular members have enough time to nominate candidates of their own choice. So you want to make sure that everybody knows, hey, these nominations are coming and we need to make, make it clear that if you want to be nominated or if you want to nominate somebody, this is the time and place. Moving on with the comment, the written comment in the book. Many NALC branches use the postal record to notify their membership of upcoming nominations and elections. However, sending the notice to the postal record office is not sufficient by itself. A branch must ensure timeliness. If the notice is untimely, the branch will be held responsible. In order to fulfill the 45-day time requirement, branches should send the notice to the postal record office at least 4 months prior to the election date. Further, upon delivery of the postal record, branches should check the election notice section and determine if the 45-day time requirement has been met. All right, so that's the obligation. If you're going to do it in writing, you know, in this mailer, instead of mailing out directly to your members, then you have to make sure that it was published properly. And again, I looked for my own branch's notification and it was not in there. Next, for those branches that decide to publish the notice in the branch newspaper, remember that notification must be on the front page and prominent. And here the word must is actually underlined. The notification must be on the front page and prominent. It should be clearly visible at a casual reading. A notice buried in the middle of an article is not adequate. Placing the notice on the front page as a separate item in large conspicuous letters fulfills the intent of the law. All right, guys. To me, probably to you, that is crystal fucking clear. That if you're going to post this in the branch newsletter, that it's got to be on the front page. It must be on the front page and it's got to be prominent. And so for me, as someone who knows this election is coming, I feel like if that was done, I feel like I'd have seen it. And so how did I miss this? Well, as I mentioned in the previous episode, maybe it was done and I just somehow I missed it. So I got word that, you know, once the last episode goes out, I have listeners in Las Vegas, and one of them actually sent an email to our branch. It happened this morning, and said, hey, I don't remember seeing these notifications. Did you actually send it out? You know, because it's required that you notify that nominations are coming. And a branch officer responded and said, yeah, we put it in the state newsletter, the Nevada State Association newsletter, as, you know, required. And as proof of that, the union officer sent along a scanned copy of the notification. And guys, where is that notification supposed to be? Go ahead, I'll give you a second to answer. I know you know the answer. It's supposed to be on the front page. And it's supposed to be super prominent in big letters, in large conspicuous letters, and so on. So on this scanned page, the notification is there, right? I was wrong. They did absolutely publish the notification in the State Association newsletter. The notification was on page 5 in the bottom right corner of the page. Guys, our branch president, he's only newly the branch president. He got appointed or succeeded our deceased branch president in January of 2024. But he's been a branch officer for a long time, and he's been part of multiple elections. And this is pretty basic. Look, I'm only going through a branch election for the first time, and I already know this because I took the time to read the fucking book. So how does this happen? And then the branch secretary, who is the one who's technically responsible for getting this published, he's been a union officer in our branch for I don't even know how long, like 30 years? Maybe 20 years, I don't know, a very long time, because as I understand it, and this goes back before my history, he preceded our previous president, and that previous president served for 17 years, and then he was, the secretary was president before that. So, like, do they not know that it's supposed to go on the front page? And, like, this basic stuff that I just read, do they not know? If they don't know, that's, it's a hell of an indictment of their abilities as union officers, especially having been in the branch for that long. But it's possible. It's possible they don't know, which would mean that this has been the status quo for a long time or nobody is bothered. And I think to give them the benefit of the doubt, I think it's possible. It's possible that it's been this way, that this is the way they've done it every election forever, you know, for the last 20 years or whatever. And nobody bothers to read these books. And that's what's different about Classes of Mail and different about me personally is I'm a rules guy and I'm going to read these rules. And reading these rules and wanting the union to actually abide by its own rules, well, that's what has me in the doghouse. That's why I can't be appointed as a union steward in my own station, that I'm still an alternate steward, even though there's been an opening for like a year. Because the union president, our current union president, pulled me aside and said directly, don't be trying to hold the union accountable. Well, this is what we get. We get a notification that's down in the bottom right corner of the page on page 5 when the rules are incredibly explicit about how the notification is supposed to be posted. So upon learning this, the person who sent the email to the branch sent back the copy of the rules with the highlighted sections and says, dude, this is what the rules are. And the branch officer responded like, oh, well, that's the secretary who's supposed to do that. Take it up with them. And so passing the buck and, you know, washing their hands up. But it's funny how fast they immediately turn on each other. So I don't know. Now the question becomes, what are we going to do? You know, if we hadn't learned these rules, if Classes of Mail didn't exist, who knows? It might have just gone on unchecked. But I looked up decisions made by the Department of Labor on union elections. And in cases like this, this is not optional. This has to be done, and it has to be done properly. We have to abide by our own rules. And this absolutely can have a material impact on the outcome of the election, because there may be people who wanted to run but never saw the notification. That's the point of the notification. And if we don't give our union officials the benefit of the doubt, then this was done maliciously in an effort to hold down potential competition. And that's why that's the intent of the law in the first place. Is you have to make this conspicuous. You have to let everybody know, because otherwise the incumbent will be like, hey, if you don't want me to run again, if you don't want me to be president, just say so to an empty room and nobody says anything. And oh, I guess I'm president again. Hey, look at that. A unanimous vote, just like Saddam Hussein. So these rules exist for a reason. So now the question is, what's going to happen 2 days from now when we're supposed to have our nominations? You know, again, from looking at the Department of Labor rulings, if this goes forward, then there's going to be a rerun of the election required because this is impropriety that affects the outcome. So I think the nominations are going to have to be delayed. And it's a shame because Michael and Jonathan and I, me and my running mates, we have like a month and a half head start on all these other candidates. We're the only ones who have been out campaigning. And so now if the election gets pushed back, then our head start becomes a lot less valuable. You know, it gives other people the chance to catch up. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's good to get everybody's message out there and whatever. But dude, we got a head start on this and we'd like to reap the rewards of it. So there you go. Look at that. Number five, it must be on the front page and prominent. A notice buried in the middle is not adequate. Dude, these people. And you know, again, this is why I'm running. Because this is important and this is basic stuff that you just have to actually care about the rules. And I get the impression that the person in charge right now doesn't care about the rules. So, moving on, we're going to continue with the commentary that's in the election booklet. Posting a notice on a station bulletin board is a good additional method of informing members of nominations and elections. It is not sufficient by itself since there is no guarantee that every member of the branch will see it. So again, we continue with this theme that everybody needs to know that these nominations are coming. Finally, if it is known that a member is temporarily living at another address, for example, a friend's home or a boarding house, the notice should be sent to that temporary address. 5.2. The notice should state A. The offices to be filled and the length of terms for each office. B. The date, time, place, and methods for submitting nominations. And C. The date, time, place, and methods for the election. See section 13.1 for time requirements for voting at stations. All right, so credit to the branch secretary. All that stuff was included in the notice. The notice just wasn't put in the right place. 5.21, the notice should also state who can request an absentee ballot, where such ballots must be received, and when requests must be made. Absentee ballots must be requested after nominations have been closed, but at least 2 weeks before the election. You know, I don't know if that was mentioned in there in the notice. I'm going to look real quick. Hold on. All right, I went and checked, and no, it does not state about requesting an absentee ballot, but I presume it's irrelevant because we're voting by mail regardless. And so an absentee ballot is just a ballot that you can mail in, and so probably there would be no difference. It's functionally identical. So that one, you know, maybe that one's okay. 5.22, if voting is held at stations and the branch meeting, the notice must inform retirees who do not wish to vote at the branch meeting that they must advise the branch financial secretary or other responsible officer of the station where they wish to vote within 5 days after the nominations. So again, for us, we're just voting by mail. 5.23, if branch bylaws provide that certain officers will be convention delegates by virtue of their office, this notice must inform the membership of this provision. You know, and I'm almost positive that our bylaws do say that, and I just looked at the notice, and I don't think it was listed in the notice, but maybe it was. All right, now I'm going to go look at that real quick. Hold on. Lucky for you guys, we have the pause button. Okay, so there's definitely no notice that officers will be convention delegates by virtue of their office. But in our local bylaws, we have Article 5, Section 5, which Part A reads, branch officers, by order of succession, shall automatically be included as delegates, unless restricted by convention delegate allowance. So I guess we'll add that to the list. Dude. Yeah, the notice must inform the membership of this provision. So there again, we have that magic word, must. Dude, this Article 5, man, it is not friendly to my branch officers. Or I guess Section 5 of the bylaws, or of the election, whatever. This stuff we just read, dude. It's not great. All right, moving on. 6.0, nomination procedure. Oh, dude, thank goodness we put 5 behind us. 6.1, the nominations should be held at least 4 weeks before the election and at least 10 days after the notice of nominations and elections has been sent out. So here again, we are not 10 days after the notice of nominations has been sent out because it wasn't properly sent out. So now this whole process is going to have to get pushed back. 6.2, each regular member has the right to nominate a candidate for any office or position to be filled. 6.3, all nominations must be made at a regular or special meeting of the branch unless branch bylaws provide that nominations may be made in writing. Both methods of nomination may be used if branch bylaws so provide. I think our bylaws only allow nominations to be in person, but they allow self-nominations. I'm pretty sure I saw that in the bylaws. All right, moving on. 6.31, if nominations are made at a branch meeting, A, the meeting must be held at the time and place announced in the notice of nominations and elections. We're going to have to do that over again. B, nominations should be a separate order of business at the meeting. C, each member present must have the opportunity to make nominations before nominations for each office are closed. And D, if a nominee is not present at the meeting, written acceptance is permissible. So I know we talked about this in that previous episode, and yes, I did submit written notification that I will accept the nomination for vice president, and that notification was accepted. So if for some reason I can't make it to the meeting, I can still be nominated. But now there is this big question hanging over the meeting. 6.32. If branch bylaws provide that nominations are to be made in writing, such nominations must be received by the recording secretary at least 30 days before the date of the election. 6.4, self-nomination is permissible. Oh, I knew I saw that somewhere. There you go. I nominate the best damn candidate that's possible for this job. Me. 6.5, no person shall accept nomination for more than one office. You know, this is the one, I think I talked about this in our bylaws, where in our bylaws, it says no person shall accept nomination for more than one office notification requirements. And the words notification requirements at the end of that sentence have to be some kind of typo. And that will be an order of business that I plan to clean up, whether I'm elected or not, at some point in the next year. I'm going to propose that change to the bylaws, that we take out the words notification requirement because, dude, it's madness. All right, and 6.6, upon nomination, every nominee must certify that he or she has not served as a supervisor for the 24 months prior to being nominated. So I'm really curious if that will be done at our elections. I guess we'll find out. So here we have, next is an example notification. That it is, dude, credit to whoever made this this brochure, because it's a big piece of paper. It's the full page. And up at the top, really big, it says notice. And then next below that, in all caps and nice and big and bold, it says official notice of nomination and election of officers of branch 8000. Dude, you know, this book has been out for a long time. And it's wild. All right, and here's another one. It's just another example of what a notice would look like. And again, it is abundantly clear. 7.0, appointment of election committee. At least 21 days before the election, the president or other body is authorized by branch bylaws should appoint a committee to conduct and supervise all aspects of the election. 7.11, no candidate for any office can be appointed to the election committee. That seems like a good policy. 7.12, one member of the committee should be appointed as chairperson. 7.13, the number of members on the election committee may be determined by the branch. 8.0, initial tasks of election committee and financial secretary. 8.1, the recording secretary should promptly give the newly formed election committee a list of all nominees for all offices. The first task of the committee is to determine the eligibility of these nominees. 8.11, to facilitate this procedure, the financial secretary should make all necessary records available to the committee. Oh, so they want to make sure that you've paid your dues. It's fair. 8.2, The financial secretary must also prepare an alphabetical list of all regular members eligible to vote. Retirees may be listed separately. Oh, when I was reading through Department of Labor decisions on union elections, one of the irregularities that they ruled on was that that retirees wound up getting two ballots each, because they had this list of all regular members, and then they also had a list of the retirees that was separate. Well, the retirees were regular members, so they wound up being on both lists, and so they got the ballots twice. The Department of Labor opted not to force a rerun of that election because it was determined that retirees did not vote twice, and that would be the problem. So as long as they didn't vote more than once, it didn't affect the outcome of the election. The decisions were really interesting, and it was cool to go through and read all that stuff in in checking the work of my own branch. Dude. All right. If voting is at... Oh, the list should be given to the chairperson of the election committee at least 10 days before the election. If voting is at both stations and a branch meeting, the list should be prepared alphabetically by the stations where members will be voting. All right, now we get into the hairy stuff. 9.0, campaign. 9.1, the branch must treat all candidates equally. Any and all privileges extended to one candidate by the branch must be extended to all candidates. Comments. An example of equal treatment. If a branch permits one candidate to copy a membership list, all other candidates must be allowed to copy it. There are no exceptions to the requirement of equal treatment. The Department of Labor scrutinizes this aspect of elections very closely and will set aside elections based upon even minor violations. And dude, that's true. They definitely were not shy about setting aside elections. And most of the results of these Department of Labor investigations wound up one of two ways. Either there was a finding that the irregularity didn't affect the outcome of the election, or the irregularity was unproven, or that the union branch or the national union or whatever voluntarily reran the election. And sometimes they voluntarily rerun, and then there's a Department of Labor oversight of the rerun of the election. So, yeah, this thing that you have to treat everybody equally, one of the cases that, if I remember right, it came up at the appeals at the end of the last national convention in Boston, was the impropriety was that the incumbents had a picture of themselves in the branch union hall, and the challenger was not allowed to go in there and take a picture inside the branch union hall, and so that was unequal. And that, yeah, that's unequal. 9.2. A branch must honor all reasonable requests to distribute campaign literature at candidates' expense. Comments. This provision is often troublesome for local branches, primarily due to different interpretations of the term reasonable. If at all feasible, branches should distribute campaign literature when asked to do so. For example, a branch should not refuse to distribute literature merely because it has a small staff which cannot handle the extra work. Instead, the branch could hire temporary help to prepare and mail the literature and charge the cost of the temporary help to the candidates. Treating all candidates the same by refusing to distribute campaign literature does not fulfill the intent of the law. So you can't just say, no, we're not doing it for anybody, and that's equal. You have to be willing to, you know, to help the candidate to get the word out. That's good to know. That may come up in our election. We'll see. So far, we've just been spreading the word ourselves. The cost of a mailer, as far as I'm concerned, is prohibitive. You know, we'd wind up spending over $1,000 on a mailer, and I just don't have that kind of money to throw at this election, especially when doing the podcast. It's free. In the event I can't, well, it's not free. I guess I'm burning, you know, now that I have multiple podcasts, like $25 a month or something on the hosting fees. Anyway, in the event a candidate cannot afford to distribute literature, the branch does not have to distribute literature free of charge. However, if a branch distributes literature for one candidate without charge, then it must do the same for all candidates. In order to avoid complaints of unequal treatment, branches should advise all candidates in advance of the conditions under which it will distribute literature and should promptly advise all candidates of any changes in those conditions. I wonder if the branch is going to notify me in advance of the conditions under which it will distribute literature, because I do have literature and it would be nice to get it distributed. guess we'll wait and see. Because right now, I haven't even officially been made a candidate because I don't get nominated until 2 days from now. 9.3. A branch can neither censor campaign literature nor require that branch representatives be permitted to read the literature before it is distributed. Yeah, that makes sense. You can't, you know, that would be like holding down your opposition. And, you know, so much of these rules are pointed at this incumbent bias, this incumbent benefit, and trying to level the playing field. And obviously, to me, that's totally reasonable. I'm all in favor of level playing fields. I'm going to tell it. No, I'll tell that story another day about when I was a fantasy football commissioner. In fact, I've probably told it on this podcast somewhere before. All right, 9.4. A branch may not use branch dues, assessments, or similar levies, or contribute anything of value to promote one candidate over another, or discriminate against any candidate. Branch funds, however, may be used for all notices and for all other expenses necessary for conducting the election. Comments. This provision is commonly violated in branch election. The bottom line is that a branch is absolutely prohibited from criticizing or endorsing any candidate in a union finance newspaper, publication, or letter. On the other hand, publication of information sheets with biographical data is permissible, providing all candidates are given an equal opportunity to submit data and the data for each candidate are given equal space and prominence. Dude, I already have my biographical, our whole ticket has our biographical information that's on the flyer that we're giving out currently. So that would be really easy if the branch is going to do that. I bet they won't. Similarly, providing newspaper space for candidates to present their views is permissible, providing all candidates are given an equal opportunity to submit their statements and are given equal space and prominence in the branch paper. Branches can also sponsor a debate at a branch meeting. However, all candidates must be informed of the time and date of the debate and must be given an equal opportunity to express their views at the meeting. So you know what we did with our ticket is we took out a full-page ad in our union newsletter, and that will come out in the next issue. And the last we heard, we're the only candidates to actually take out an ad. You know, it'll be interesting to see if any of these other things, like with biographical information or whatever, if any of that is actually put in the newspaper or, you know, in our branch newsletter. 9.5, the United States Postal Service may not contribute money or anything of value to the campaign of any candidate. So this is one of those things where, like, I was reading a Department of Labor ruling about a candidate's flyer. It was an APWU case, and it was in the processing plant, and a candidate's flyer was left on the time clock, and it was ruled that that was inappropriate. However, there was no evidence that the candidate themselves put it on the time clock, and once it's out of the candidate's hands, they don't have any control over what happens to it after that. And so it was ruled like no harm, you know, that the candidate did not behave inappropriately. But another thing they said in that ruling was that, like, if the flyer had been in the break room, then that would have been no problem. The issue was that it was on the time clock, which is like, you know, management's location. And so that makes me wonder. I'm pretty confident that I have seen campaign literature in break rooms at our stations. But I don't know if that's appropriate or not. So if you know, like, definitively, yes, you can put your campaign literature in the break rooms or on the NALC bulletin board, let me know, because I really need to know that. And we're, you know, it's close on time, and I don't want to do anything untoward, unlike the people who are running the branch. I'm not interested in breaking any of these rules. So if you know for sure, like, whether I can put it on the bulletin board or in the break room, let me know, classesofmail@gmail.com. 9.6, branch officers and candidates may not campaign on union time. So the argument about campaigning on company time falls under 9.5, that the Postal Service can't contribute anything of value. So if they let you campaign while you're on the clock, that's inappropriate also. 9.7, branch officers and candidates may not use branch funds, employees, office space, telephones, facilities, equipment, or materials to campaign. There you go. The branch provides nothing of value to these candidates. And 9.8, no campaigning is allowed within a polling place during voting. All right, now I know this episode's getting fairly long, so we're going to stop it at 10, which is the pre-election duties of election committee. So this brings us all the stuff that's supposed to be done before the election, and then when we come back on a future episode, we're going to read all the rules about the election itself. 10.1, the election committee is in charge of the preparation of ballots for the election. The committee may prepare approximately 5% more ballots than the number of eligible voters to replace any ballots spoiled by the voters. All ballots must be safeguarded by the committee at all times, and at all times is underlined. 10.11. Any reasonable method for listing candidates on the ballots may be used, provided that no candidate is unfairly promoted or disadvantaged. Acceptable methods include the following. A. Listing candidates alphabetically. B. Listing candidates in order of their nominations. C. Listing candidates on a rotating ballot. D. Listing candidates in an order determined by a random draw. E. Listing candidates as a slate, provided that voters are allowed to choose among individual candidates. To avoid any misunderstanding, the voting instructions must specifically inform the voter that he or she need not vote for the entire slate. I can't remember how we do it at our branch. I think we do it alphabetically, but I'm not certain. That was another ruling, was that it was an NALC election, a branch election, and they were supposed to list candidates with the incumbent first. Here, 10.111, incumbent candidates or slates may be listed first only if that is the established branch practice. And this person was an incumbent, and they were listed second, and they wound up losing their election. And so the Department of Labor investigated, said, yeah, that is the past practice, and yes, you did lose the election, but we don't think that that would have changed the outcome of the election, because there were other people who were listed second who were victorious. And so it appears that there wasn't a strong correlation between your position on the ballot and the fact that you lost this election. So again, these rulings, I found them very interesting. All right, 10.112. Except for nicknames, ballots must not include any identifying information about the candidate. Therefore, any reference to incumbency anywhere on the ballot is prohibited. So to me, this contradicts 10.111, where you can list incumbents first. All right. 10.12. Instructions on the ballot should state that if a voter signs his or her name on the ballot, the entire ballot will be void. Comments. Preparation of ballots must be done with great care. Names of candidates should be spelled correctly. Ask candidates how they want their names spelled on the ballot. Dude, it would not surprise me even a tiny bit if they spelled my name wrong on the ballot. Nor if they spelled Michael Brazenly's name wrong on the ballot. Dude, we'll see. If they're reading this manual, then they'll know they should take great care and they should ask me. And they've got it written down. I don't know. Maybe they'll get it right. 10.2. The election committee must prepare a voting register, which is a list of members eligible to vote with adequate space available for each voter's signature. This register should be prepared from the membership list provided by the financial secretary, Section 8.2. 10.21. If voting is held at both stations and the branch, voting registers must be prepared for each station. These station voting registers must include the names of each station's active workers. Station registers must also include the names of those retirees who wish to vote at that station, Section 13.3. Comments. The purpose of this regulation is to ensure that no one votes twice and to avoid giving ballots to ineligible persons. And finally, 10.3. The election committee must promptly send absentee ballots to all eligible members who request them, Section 5.21 and 11.5, along with instructions, a ballot, a secret ballot envelope, and a prepaid business reply or stamped envelope. The instructions and three enclosures should be identical to those for mail balloting. So there you go. That's pretty much the same. Mail balloting and absentee balloting. Yeah, there's no practical difference, it looks like. But I did not know that they would be in a postage paid envelope. So that's interesting. I thought for sure voters would have to provide their own stamp. All right. So anyway, that's the election rules. And dude, number five, what a doozy. And I'm recording this on Monday, and I just had an episode drop this morning. So I'm probably going to have this episode drop on Wednesday morning, which is the day of the election. And so, you know, probably by the time you're listening to this, we will know how they're going to handle the inappropriate notification of nominations. And I'll let you guys know how it goes. This has been interesting. That is for sure. So anyway, thanks for listening, guys. And thanks for joining me on this journey through my first ever election. And I'll keep you posted, and I'll catch you next time.